Hello, America, and all of our listeners all around the world. You're listening to yet another exciting episode of Let's Weekend. I'm your host, Brandon Perkins, the host with the most. As always, with me is Chris Belogi. Yes, a two-man crew tonight. Say hi, guy, to the good people, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah, so it's going to be, this is January 27th. It's going to be the last show for the month. Next time we'll be talking to you, we will be in the very beginning of February. I'll be honest with you, the weather for the month of January has been extremely bizarre this year. And I'll probably be talking about it a little more later on, but, just like last week, you know, it was like super duper cold. It was like getting down to like the 20s and even the teens, which, you know, that's for this part of the country, that's pretty cold. So you had all that stuff. But this week we had a warm front come in, and amongst other things, it meant that the temperatures climbed up into like the 70s, which, you know, it's Georgia. Weather gets weird down here this time of year. But what came also with it was humidity. And I don't know if you've ever had to deal with a humid winter before, but it sucks. You're kind of chilly, but you're also, you know, the air is really thick. And so you've got moisture just clinging to you. It's very, very uncomfortable. It's not fun at all. But anyway, obviously, other than just, you know, random weather shit, we had some other stuff to be talking about this week to talk about. The end of former President Trump's ongoing, law. Well, it's not a lawsuit. He already lost that. It was a civil trial. He lost it. And this week he was finally sentenced. And we found out how much he's going to have to pay. We'll be telling you, just say it's a lot. We also have the ongoing shit that's going down near the American-Mexican border, which is getting just out of hand. The situation is escalating very quickly, or at least, you know, the ones involved want to make it look like it is. I honestly doubt anything serious is going to happen, but we'll be talking about that. And of course, we've also got a bunch of new stuff that happened for the New Hampshire primary, including basically it's now officially just a two-person primary in the Republican race now. Because we all knew who was going to win. It was pretty much like nobody, we all knew it was going to go that way. What we didn't expect is that the other candidate would end up getting as many votes as she ended up getting. And of course, we've also got a bunch of entertainment stuff related, as well as a certain comedian returning to host as a guest host for a show that he hosted for a good, I think, 15 years. And of course, we got a bunch of trailers, including the trailer for a new live action edition of a very well-loved animated series that isn't being directed by you-know-who, and actually looks good and has like effort behind it. We got all that and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. So, as we always start off with, Chris, what have you been doing this week?
Dealing with the nicer weather, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's been raining most days
for
the past week. But we have managed to get a couple days up in the 50s to mm-hmm. help melt most of that snow. So, that's been nice. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, all rain kind of being annoying otherwise. Mm-hmm. So, and a foggy day. One of those days where it's just kind of foggy all day.
Oh, yeah.
That's been fun to see. Mm-hmm. But, for things I've been watching, not really watching anything new. I was looking around on Netflix for stuff to watch, and I watched something mm-hmm. I had not seen in quite a while, Apollo mm-hmm. 13. A movie about one of the more daring Apollo missions, mm-hmm. Where they were hoping to go back to the moon. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of after a number of other missions that, as they talk about, you know, it has not become a big deal anymore for the general public, taking that all for granted. And the kind of stuff that went on before they launched as somebody was exposed to measles, is in case you need to remember what life was like before the vaccine for that. So they had to remove that person and put a new person in. None of the things that happened was a result of any of that changing of the people on the mission. It was a result of a technical failure that was made, you know, in the process of building the ship. That kind of thing. But yeah, this was a Ron Howard movie, right? That is just very good. Just the astronauts dealing with the rapidly descending capability of the ship to sustain their mission, and then having to essentially switch to the lander and be able to fly that back home under some dire circumstances and all that. So just a great movie. Very fun, especially if you're into space stuff with that. So yeah, that's one. And then I checked on Netflix and had those categories like, oh, because you watched Apollo 13, I recommended I watch Breaking Bad. I was like, what? How do you get to those two things? Other than people putting shit together that you wouldn't expect, I guess. I don't know. But that was a thing. But I've been watching more King of the Hill. Like, I'm in season 5 now. There's a really great episode that is when Bobby turns 13. And it's basically a teen drama episode as Joseph comes back from summer camp, you know, going through puberty, being much taller than he was before. And then Bobby is sort of a chill, you know, about to be teenager who's holding this party and all that. And lots of drama ensues, lots of funny moments, especially as one of the plots, B or C plots, is that Peg's disappointed that Bobby doesn't want her to bring the cake into the party. And so with all the chaos of things going on, as the kids crash the Bugabago into a light pole and run off, and as people in the neighborhood kind of find this vehicle crash there, she just shows up with the cake, being like, yeah, boy, I served your cake 13 years. All that. Very funny moments. Still a good show. But yeah, that's been what I've been watching. Not really too much of consequence. But for games, with Final Fantasy VII Rebirth coming out in about a month, I got back into Remake. Been playing a few hours of that today. Basically the point where Cloud and Aerith are escaping from the situation that was happening in, I forget what sector it was, but basically going back to her hometown and like helping out the locals and all that, is Cloud is still just an emotionally unavailable person. And she's trying to get him to open up by helping out like the local kids and all this. And you go into their hideout and have all the weird stuff happening there. And especially when they're like, well, there's the Frog King's here and you got to go kill him. And that dude fucking whooped me because I didn't understand the mechanics of that. Because the king just brings back the health of the other creatures that are helping him. And so I was, you know, just wailing on the first one that I got locked onto kind of thing. And then eventually wore us down. So I had to rethink that fight. Was able to get through it. But yeah, basically doing all the quests I can, because you get stuff out of it that's worthwhile for the most part. So you can tell that I look at every nook and cranny of the game as I can, because at this point I have about 70 potions. Because I have a cure. So why use potions? That doesn't use up anything. Especially how often a lot of these quests are just like, oh, we'll refill all your health and mana. So yeah, kind of getting back into the game here. I'm in chapter 9 now, where we are about to deal with Don Corneo. As you see Tifa going off in a little carriage towards his place, and then you're like, well, we can't let you go back to Sector 7. You got to deal with Don Corneo and I'm assuming all the dress stuff and all that. So that'll be a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like the bits and the going through the tunnels and such there, where she keeps Aerith keeps, you know, putting her hands up for high fives, and he just keeps being like, "What is that?" And then he eventually puts his hand up for a high five, and she doesn't realize it. And then you have to go through a whole bit holding down the triangle button to do a high five, and it's like, "All right, you paid off this dumb little bit here where he's such a stick in the mud. He doesn't want to do anything fun." The whole thing, but yeah, that game's still very good. Maybe my only knock, and it would probably be alleviated by just turning down the difficulty, is just how grindy it is. You'll take on, you know, a number of fights and get like 32 XP out of each one, even the tougher ones, and it's like, yeah, this is a very slow leveling game for all it does there. So, but yeah, that's that. So looking forward to playing more of it. I'm about halfway through the game now because I think it's 18 chapters.
Yeah.
And I'm on number 9, so not too far. Because I'm in 9 chapters after like 16 hours. So I know it's not a super long game. Unless you absolutely want to do everything in there.
Yeah.
And I'm at least like checking out everything. But that's not a super long game, but I assume Rebirth is going to be, because it's more open-ish areas you're going to be exploring. So they'll absolutely fill that up with stuff to do. But yeah, that's been the thing I'm working on playing. The other game I'm playing some more of is Spirit Hunters. I have beaten all the maps on hard mode and gotten the trophy for that. I'm working on brutal mode, which as you can tell is tougher. On that, and then I'm trying to get all there's the second part of the skill tree, which requires the top currency that you have to either play on brutal mode versions of the map to get it to drop, or you convert all the other currencies to it. So I'm basically just playing levels and taking all the currencies I get and just converting it all down to this one, and then all that does is upgrade stats for the various weapons in the game. And you're doing like one at a time, slowly making them better and better. So I assume at worst you upgrade that stuff enough, it'll make you better at taking on those brutal mode maps. But yeah, that's been pretty much what I've been playing. So Brandon, what have you been doing?
Well, as far as gaming is concerned, I am just about done with Pokemon Scarlet. I've basically more or less completed the three primary like objectives of the game. I've beaten all the gym leaders. I've fought all of the Titan Pokemon, as well as the last guy that you have to do before you can move on to that point, next point. And I've also beat all the members of Team Star except their mysterious leader. So basically what has to happen now is I have to go to the, the headquarters of where the Pokemon League are headquartered for that particular part of the Pokemon world. And I have to fight, the Legendary Four, basically, which is going to be not easy. This is the part where you got to kind of go out and start grinding a bit, because these last four fights famously kind of happen one after another. So, got to do that. And then I've also got to beat the leader of Team Star, and they are supposed to be really difficult to fight because they all rely on one specific kind of Pokemon that is very strong and has a lot of like status damage that they can do. And I can't move on to like the next section until I beat either one of those. So yeah, until I can accomplish either one of those things, I'm basically stuck. So in the meantime, I've also been playing, Fear and Hunger, and I mentioned how Fear and Hunger is like notoriously difficult. There's a thing I forgot to mention when I was describing this game, which is that this game kind of also has like an RNG mechanic to it, because whenever something like an event happens, like say you're going through and suddenly there's like a hole that's going to open up underneath you in the floor, or you're in the middle of a fight and they're about to do like a power move on you or stuff like that. Or you're needing to like get in, there's like special areas where you'll need to like get some kind of equipment or object or something. It then goes into a literal coin flip. It's a coin flip. There is a part where you can like get extra coins where you can do like flip two coins at once, which means there's a possibility of like getting a, getting a draw and being able to flip again. But, once it's done, you can't go back and do it again. If you want to go back and do it again, you basically have to start the whole run all over again. But I've managed to get a couple of the endings. Like I mentioned, Fear and Hunger is not a very long game. You could theoretically finish the whole thing in about 5 hours. But because of the amount of stuff that's in it and all the things you can encounter, one playthrough is rarely the same as another. So, there's like a whole bunch of stuff that opens up as you play through it. And I've gotten a couple of the endings. I have not gotten a bunch of the others. I want to get I want to be able to get like further into the game where there's like a whole area that's like cut off with this door that you can't access unless you go through a particular sequence of events. But I want to do that. And I also I'm going to go and get a copy of Fear and Hunger Termina off of Steam as well, because I've been told that that game is a little more straightforward. And unlike Fear and Hunger, which is a lot more survival horror-ish in its approach, Termina, although it's still pretty messed up, is a lot more straightforward and more RPG. And it does like encourage combat more than Fear and Hunger does. But yeah, that's what I've been playing. And as for other stuff, Hazbin Hotel. It had the 5th and 6th episodes came out this week. Actually, they came out Thursday. Well, technically they come out on Friday, but they come out like at a specific time, like a time zone that makes it so that they come out early in the evening in where I live in the Eastern Standard Time Zone. I still love it to pieces. I really do. And honestly, I'm excited to see how this season's going to end, because we get the penultimate and then season finale next week. And there's like a lot of stuff that's building up and like a lot of things that is getting really interesting. I will say there is one issue I have with it, and it's one that a lot of people have brought up. And I don't necessarily fault the makers for this, because this is sort of just how the industry is. It moves at a very rapid pace. There are, because like every episode sort of has like an A plot and a B plot, and both plots are like really good, but because they're having to condense it all into 8 episodes, there's parts where it's like they could very obviously like dedicate a whole episode to one of these plots if they could. Unfortunately, they can't, because anybody who knows anything about animation over here in the U.S. is that when animated series is greenlit, it's rarely ever guaranteed like a second season. So there's like this pressure to try and get as much out as you can in the first season, just in case it'll end up getting it'll not be continued. Now, fortunately, we are definitely getting a second season. They've already started the recording process for it, but they actually did not find out they were greenlit for another season until about halfway through production. So, yeah. But otherwise, yeah, it's amazing. I love it. I love the story. I love these characters. I love the music, especially. If you ever wanted to ask me, what is the one way that you can guarantee a musical will be good? It has to have that one song that can legitimately bring you to tears. And Hazbin Hotel has one song that can legitimately bring me to tears. But yeah, so once again, if you haven't watched it yet, go watch it. It's amazing, and I highly recommend it. But other than that, just the normal stuff, you know, music, not really much there. And just the fact that, you know, humid winters suck. I say it again. Remember, I have to work at a grocery store, and part of the stuff that I do at a grocery at my job is I have to do some working outside on occasions, which isn't fun, but it has to be done. And yeah, so I had to go outside and, you know, work in that, you know, that humid weather, and it wasn't a lot of fun. But anyway, so yeah, that has been my week. You got anything else you want to add before we move on, Chris?
Nope.
All right. Well, in that case, it's now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And this week, I just wanted to talk a little bit briefly about it's a lot, you know, this type of game is a lot more popular now because, for one thing, they're kind of cheap to make. And a single person can theoretically make one and become very popular while doing it, you know. But it's one of those games that, you know, it took a long time before it was able to take off over here in the West because it required, you know, a sort of cultural shift where we realize that, you know, a part of really good games doesn't necessarily just have to be the gameplay. The gameplay can be great, and that can dominate it. But if a game also has really good writing, that is also something that will stick, that will make it stick in a person's mind, even if, you know, there's very little actual what we would consider gameplay to think of. And that is the visual novel. Well, although they don't call that, they don't call them that over in Japan. They call them Nobiro Gemo, or novel games. And the history of this particular genre actually has its roots actually back in the sort of origins of modern Japanese gaming. So Chris, have you ever played some visual novels that you've actually like genuinely loved?
I haven't really gotten into too many of them.
That's understandable.
Like Persona's probably the...
Persona definitely has a lot of visual novel elements to it.
Yeah, because what you're doing between, you know, your daily stuff or your dungeon stuff is all visual novels, basically.
Yeah. Honestly, over here, I don't think visual novels really became like a thing for a long time. Like, I think probably for a lot of people over here, their first exposure to like the idea of like that, you know, the idea of reading something in a game that's like not just some random text, it's like plot heavy and meant to be read, might have been the old Xbox 360 game Lost Odyssey. Lost Odyssey was a JRPG that was made by the creator of Final Fantasy, his independent studio, and it was one of the two games that he made for the 360, the other one being Blue Dragon. And that the sort of big part of that game is that the guy you're playing is an immortal, and he's lived about 1,000 years. And as you go through the game, you can pick up these things that are basically like memories of the lives that he's led through his immortality. And they're not like played like cutscenes. They're not played as mini games. They're literally text on a screen with background music and some scenic visuals in the background. And people who have played that game have pointed out that it's actually like very a heavy part of the actual game itself. You don't necessarily have to do it if you don't want to, but they are there, and they're generally one of the more acclaimed parts of that game. But obviously the idea of like having all text games in and of themselves are nothing new. Over here in the West, we had games like Zork, you know, which was a literal like text adventure game. Text adventures were like one of the early parts of computer gaming. But those are like those aren't really like what visual novels are, mostly because, again, they're all text, so there's almost no visuals to speak of. But over in Japan, they also had text-based games as well, but they were much more niche and did not really have as big an audience as like later actual visual novels would get. The first game that we can give this term to that more or less sort of defined it is a game called the Portopia Serial Murder Case. This was a game that came out originally it came out for the NEC PC 6001 and was eventually ported over to the Famicom about a year or so later. And of course the Famicom, that is what we in the US call the Nintendo Entertainment System. It was a adventure game, a sort of like where you're like, it was a murder mystery, essentially. And it was like one of those like first person adventure games that used to be like really common, like on like the Macintosh, like those types of games where it's like you would go through like various rooms and there would be things you could click on and you could put stuff in your inventory. Like, for example, like Shadowgate, for example, that's a really good example. And yeah, it had a point and click interface, command menu system, 3D dungeon maze, all that stuff. And you're essentially talking to various people, going through interviews, having conversations. There's branching dialogue. The gameplay itself is very nonlinear. You can essentially go through the whole thing in any, you know, order that you want, as long as you know, and eventually get to the conclusion. This game was a massive hit. It sold 700,000 copies when it was released on the Famicom. It was literally called a, quote, game without game over by the press. What's especially unique about this is two things. One, it was published by Enix. This was a game they actually published before they hit on Dragon Quest. And the other thing, speaking of Dragon Quest, is that this game was written and designed by Dragon Quest creator Yuji Ori. In fact, he created a whole trilogy of games specifically based around this detective character that you play as and this plot that you uncover. This game ended up inspiring a lot of people, and specifically it inspired Hideo Kojima, who would go on to do his own sort of visual novel adventure games later on. And that's more or less sort of where the story takes us. There's another game that came out right around that time. It was called Crystal Dragon, and it was a adventure game, again, that was put out by Square back when they were just Squaresoft. It was more of a cult hit. It did not do as well as Portopia did, mostly because its interface was a little bit more, I guess, opaque than, you know, Portopia's was. Portopia's was a lot more self-explanatory. Crystal Dragons was not. But it definitely did have like a huge like cult following. And part of it had to do with this sort of rumor that started going around that there's this one character who's like this girl that there's like a part in the game where her arms are like outstretched towards you. And there was this rumor that went around that if you put in a specific code of buttons, it would then create a rock, paper, scissors game. And if you won the rock, paper, scissors game against her, she would take her top off. That's going to be kind of important to the story when we get going, and I'll show you why. Okay. So that happened, and so a few years later, Hideo Kojima ended up going to Konami. And while he was at Konami, he finally got the chance to, you know, make his first game. And that first game that he ended up making was a game called Snatcher. It came out in 1988, and anybody who knows anything about Kojima knows that he loves his movie references, and he especially loves putting in movie images when he can. And anybody who is like, first turns on Snatcher and sees the very beginning, we'll look and it's like, oh, this is Blade Runner. Like, legitimately, the very beginning is like there's like the glass pyramid and like the fire spouts coming out of the towers and, you know, the various hover cars going everywhere and all that stuff. There's the blimp with like the advertisement on it. It's all, yeah, it's straight up that. But That game more or less played a lot like these other two games, where it was a detective story where you're trying to track down a murderer, which involves you having to talk to various people, you know, interviews. There are various parts that happen here and there where you are put into gunfights where you're on like a 9x9 grid and you have to move the cursor over as fast as you can so that you can fight and shoot various enemies before, you know, they shoot and kill you. He had another game, a sort of spiritual successor to that, that came out later on called Police Knots. And Police Knots, when you boot this game up, you're like, oh, this is a Lethal Weapon, but in the future. And that's exactly what it is. It's more or less got a lot of the same stuff, clicking around, trying to find stuff, interviews, talking to people. The big difference this time is that because it was released on the Sega Saturn, they were able to take the shooting mechanic out of a 9-point grid to like a full-on shooting mechanic because, you know, you could get a light gun and actually like shoot the enemies on screen. So you had that happen. And pretty much from like 1990 onward is when like visual novels as we know them more or less became like a real medium. And you have to understand that almost all of them were porn. Every single one of them, all of them, from the very beginning to the very end, they were all porn. Just every single one. And that was the reason why, like, basically so much of the visual novel material that you'll consume is in some way, you know, explicit. And that's because it is. That's pretty much what built the industry, was that stuff. And the flip side to that is you ended up, because that's basically how all these things were done, how they were basically all porn, you ended up getting a lot of like uniquely talented individuals who would find ways to make these games incredibly interesting. Outside of the, the sex stuff. For example, there was the game Eve Burst Error that came out in 1995, which was unique because it had a switching multiple protagonist system where at any time you could switch from one character to the other even before the first character scenario had finished. On top of that, both characters actually have to cooperate with each other during various points, and there's like choices involved that will branch out the path. That's another major part of these games, is that although they typically don't have a whole lot of real gameplay, there's usually branching paths involved that where you have to choose particular actions or statements to make, and then whatever happens will end up giving you a completely different end depending on how it goes. So you would get games like this. There was also games like the Viper series, which was that particular series went on for a long time. Unfortunately, the company behind that ended up shutting its doors, I think, in like 2005. There were a lot of like sci-fi related games that usually involved porn. There's the various famous Rant series, which is both famous and notorious, both for the fact that it has like a really well-written, fleshed-out universe, but also features a guy that's, as your character, is like a really kind of creepy dirtbag. But the game that's like particularly considered to be the sort of beginning where this particular medium really started to catch off as more of a mainstream gaming thing instead of just a niche was a game that came out called You Know, A Girl Who Chants Love at the Bound of This World. It was created by a company called Elf. Elf themselves had made a bunch of really porny visual novels up to this point. But this game was specifically interesting because of the amount of depth and writing and plot that happens. It has a nonlinear storyline with a science fiction plot revolving around time travel and parallel universes. So as the character, you get to travel between parallel worlds, which employs a limited number of stones to mark a certain position as a returning location, so that if the player decides to retrace their steps, they can go to an alternate universe to the time they have used a reflector stone. So there's like this recurring thing that happens. And on top of that, it includes a mapping system that sort of shows you the course that you're taking on the various branching plot lines. And like, if you want to go back and redo something, you can just go back and do it. Because of this, we would end up getting, essentially bring the whole visual novel genre to a legit, like, respectable medium. But it would take a little bit longer for that to happen. So I mentioned earlier the Rant series. Rants is created by a company called Alisoft. And back in the mid-90s, they decided to hire this new guy who was fresh out of college. His name was Jun Maeda. And any of you who are anime fans may know that name. I will explain who he is in a little bit. Jun Maeda was a guy who had long been a fan of gaming books and stuff, and he wanted to start coding. And originally what he wanted to do is to make music for games. He was a huge fan of the band TM Network, and he essentially learned to write music by like coding TM Network's music chords into their computer and having it replay it. But unfortunately, he was not able really to break into the industry at that point, so he had to take a job as a scenario writer for Alisoft. And while he was there, he got put on a game called Chaos Queen Ryoko, which is the first game that he's generally agreed upon to have worked on. He didn't really like the he did not like the whole world living there. So he decided he was going to move on to another company. He went and went working with another company called Tactics. And over there, he worked on a couple more games. He worked on a game called Moon, which was their second game. And he also worked on a game called One, Kagayaku Kisetsu, which came out in 1998. In both of these games, he both helped write the scenario, and he also composed a lot of the music. He also met up with a lot of his frequent collaborators there, such as Itaro Hinoe, Shinji Orito, Naoki Hiyasa, and ODKS. They decided to go out and they left Tactics to go and start their own company called Visual Arts. Well, they didn't found Visual Arts. Visual Arts actually already existed, but they decided to go and form their own studio underneath Visual Arts, the publishing company. And that company became known as Key. So in 1999, they released a game called Canon. And this game was a huge hit. It proved extremely popular. It was popular. So they then did another game after that, and this one was called Air. This game was so popular that they actually released a game that was a version of the game that was completely safe for work. Both Canon and Air were like Maeda's previous games, basically supposed to be eroge, you know, porn games. But a lot of the writing that was involved was so good that they were able to release a version completely without any of the sex stuff, and it sold like crazy. So then in 2004, they released their third and longest game at that time, which was called Clannad. It was a completely 100% all-ages visual novel, and it was a huge hit. It was massive. It was a freaking cultural phenomenon. It was the inspiration for an anime that was a massive hit. It basically rewrited like all of what like anime was, like all the trends in anime at that time basically were rerouted because of this title. And pretty much after that, he pretty much kept putting out bangers. He put out Little Busters after it. He put out a bunch of other stuff afterwards. And more than anyone else, Key is pretty much responsible for taking the visual novel medium and making it like a respectable gaming medium that anybody can do and watch and not have to, you know, be involved with any type of weird sex stuff if you don't want to. Because of that particular series, we ended up getting a bunch of other amazing stuff. See, the thing about all of Key's games is that they're what are called utsuge, or crying games, because all these games basically have it where you have all these characters that you really like, and there's a lot of humor and comedy and slice of life related stuff, and you really grow to love these characters, and then just really awful shit happens to them step by step until you're left a crying, sobbing puddle of goo. But that inadvertently ended up starting another trend in visual novels, which was the horror genre. That game that can particularly be related to a little game that I know, love, and well, that I've played before and very much recommend to anybody who loves scary shit, Higurashi When They Cry, which came out in 2002 by Zero Seventh Expansion. After that, we ended up getting a bunch of other games as well. Some very well-known examples include science fiction games like Chaos Head and Steins Gate. We have the Konami Dating Sim Tokimeki Memorial, which Kojima actually did work on. He actually developed the first three in the series. And of course, there's still making porn stuff. But in the Western world, we actually started getting games like this. We started getting games like Ace Attorney, the Professor Layton series, 999, 9 hours, 9 persons, 9 doors, Ghost Trick, Danganronpa, the Life is Strange series, which is more or less a visual novel if you forget the fact that there's a lot of walking around and stuff. But probably, I think, when people think of visual novels in the Western world, there's one game that everybody remembers, and that's Doki Doki Literature Club. On top of the fact that, you know, it has that incredible, like, meta-horror sort of thing going with it. But yeah, that's the visual novel genre. It's a genre that's been around for a long time, but it only really sort of took off in the last probably few years, really. And that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. Yeah, so with that out of the way, it's now time to start the show proper. And as always with the show proper, we start off with our assholes of the week. And we start off with the news that the Palestinian death toll in the ongoing Israeli Hamas conflict has now surpassed 25,000 people. A lot of them children.
Yeah. Kind of sad to see them hit this. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and it's not even just Palestinians. A number of Israelis have been killed by their own government. Mm-hmm. Stories even recently of some trying to go over there to do whatever it was, decided to go back and got shot by their own people.
Yep.
Because they weren't, you know, wearing any sort of military outfits or anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think at least like half of that 25,000 is kids.
Yep.
And that's just makes it all the more depressing.
Yep. Yeah, it is very depressing. This also comes with the fact that the International Criminal Court has announced that there is a risk of genocide in Palestine now. So, yeah, it's getting serious.
And I think one of their ministers basically tweeted Hag Schmeg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is a great thing to say to show the disgust you have with any sort of genocide courts stuff going on.
Yep. Oh, wonderful, wonderful. And then we also have the Peter Navarro, who is a former advisor to former President Trump. He was officially sentenced to 4 months in prison for contempt of Congress.
Yep. Is that what he deserves?
Yeah.
We need to get Steve Bannon in there as well.
Yes, please. I very much want that to happen.
Bannon was found guilty in 2022, the same charges.
Mm-hmm.
Also sentenced to 4 months, but then appealed his conviction.
Mm-hmm.
I guess still waiting for that appeal.
Yep.
So that's weird, but
yeah.
Hopefully Navarro doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see.
Yeah. And we find out that Vince McMahon has resigned from TKO after sex abuse scandal. Yeah, turns out there's a new one.
Yeah, and this one is
much more serious than the last one was.
Yeah. Let's see. Former WWE employee filed a lawsuit against him, the company, and former WWE executive John Laurinaitis.
Mm-hmm.
The lawsuit alleges that McMahon abused and sexually exploited her and also trafficked her to other men,
mm-hmm.
including Laurinaitis, who was formerly WWE's head of talent relations.
Yep.
And, yeah, the... you can read for further details. It's all very grim,
mm-hmm.
kind of unsurprising based on the other things that we have heard about what Vince has done that led to him stepping down previously,
mm-hmm.
And taking a break from being a public figure for the WWE.
Mm-hmm.
But now that they essentially sold off to the UFC parent company and formed TKO, yeah. He was kind of taken a back seat. At a certain point, I believe he still has stock in this company. So him stepping down from the board is something, but he's still able to be involved in some form.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no idea where this lawsuit goes. But yeah, this is just some grim shit.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Variety here knows the best way to handle this. They put that ridiculous picture of him, I think when he announced I forget what this is from, where he dyed his hair and his mustache,
mm-hmm.
and looks like some snively whiplash shit.
Yeah.
Tying up women on train tracks kind of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, you're a pathetic old man if you're trying to dye your hair.
Yeah.
After everybody knows what your hair color looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Looks like Howard Hughes if he was made out of wax and melting.
Yeah. So, yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So, yeah. Screw that guy. Now for the other thing. We had been talking about the ongoing sort of civil trial that E. Jean Carroll had brought against former President Trump. He had been found guilty of sexually assaulting her, and now it was about the sentencing of how much he needed to pay. Well, we got the sentence from the jury themselves, and they decided that he was to pay $83 million. Yeah.
Yeah. $83.3 million,
mm-hmm.
For ruining her credibility as an advice columnist when he called her a liar after she accused him of sexual assault.
Yep.
Let's see. They awarded her $65 million in punitive damages, $11 million for the damage to her reputation,
mm-hmm.
and another $7.3 million. Trump is probably going to try to appeal. He may not have that right because this is a civil suit.
Yeah, and if he wants to appeal, he also has to like put up a portion of the ordered money as bond. So
I want to say it might have to be more than that, more than what the amount is. And this is going to be something he's going to try to not pay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be a legal thing to do, but that's what he's done the rest of his life is just refuse to pay.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this is a whole thing.
Yep.
Well, yeah, somebody used some chalk to write down some fun stuff about this outside of one of the Trump properties. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah.
I think he stormed out at the end.
Oh yeah, he definitely did.
Like while E. Jean Carroll's representation was doing their final statement,
mm-hmm.
he just stormed out. So
yep.
In case you're wondering where he's at mentally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do we got? Oh, yeah. And, this one. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, has planning to defy the Supreme Court ruling that he needs to allow the Border Patrol to take down barbed wire at the border. And, yeah, it's kind of escalated since then. He's not only started putting the wire back up, he's also started putting those buoys up as well, the ones with the saw blades on them. And now there's like a bunch of governors from, I think, like a bunch of states, which, by the way, if you notice the map that shows them, other than Texas, none of them actually share a border with Mexico.
Yeah.
Have all sort of gone in solidarity with them. Now, this is going to end up in being a huge mess. Because there's now like a so-called trucker convoy that's supposed to be going down there now. And yeah, it's going to be a flustercuck basically.
Yeah. It's, So the thing about the border is that the state is not allowed to do anything about the border because the actual border is federal land. Plus some X amount of space on both sides of it. And then there's like a dead man's land between them that Mexico and the U.S. do not own. At least in some areas, depending on it. But a lot of what Texas has is the Rio Grande River is acting as their border. So essentially they are not supposed to be doing anything with that water because that is essentially federal land. But Greg Abbott's trying to make some point that the federal government isn't doing anything. And what they're trying to do is take down the illegal measures that he and the Texas National Guard have been doing. And trying to, you know, kick out the Border Patrol from doing their job and all that, which their job is not supposed to be keeping everybody out. They're supposed to, you know, gather the people that have come over and put them through the system and all that. And, you know, determine if they need to be held or, you know, put through the asylum system, all that kind of stuff. It's all very complicated. And then you got the whole thing where Congress is working on some deal that may or may not actually do much. But McConnell and the GOP, especially Trump, don't want them to do it because that hands Biden a win. So attempting to do anything about the thing they've been complaining about, they now want to not do it because then that would make Biden look better. And it's like, listen, you do anything here, you're still going to complain about it. That's literally what they've been doing. But yeah, we have some stuff here where they're trying to make it seem like it's going to be the start of a civil war.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now we have our heroes of the week. We got a couple. And the first one is the Federal Trade Commission. They barred Intuit, which are the makers of TurboTax, from advertising any free products and services unless they're free for all. Because for those who know who have ever had to use TurboTax before or tried to use it, they kind of try to trick you at first. Because it was one of those loopholes that they were able to use. Well, they can't use that loophole no more.
Yeah. They either go with the... So I think all of the major tax companies have a free service, but they don't advertise it, don't make it easily available on like the main sites. You have to essentially, you know, Google for it or whatever. And it's all that kind of stuff. But they will offer free options, but generally when you're working through these services, they'll like gray out stuff like, oh, if you fall in here, you need to pay. Conveniently, for all that, but yeah, the IRS is starting to put out their free service for filing your taxes. Here, I think it's in a trial run for this year. Probably go wide next year if it goes well. With all that, but yeah, Intuit was ordered to stop advertising any free products and services unless they're free for all consumers, or unless the company discloses on the ad the percentage of people would be eligible for the unpaid offerings. The director of the FTC's Bureau of Consumer Protection said the vast majority of Intuit's customers could take advantage of what the company claimed it was providing at no charge. Instead, they were upgraded into costly deluxe and premium products. As the commission has long understood, free is a powerful allure, one that Intuit deployed in scores of ads. Its attempts to qualify its free claim were ineffective and often inconspicuous. So, yeah.
Yep.
Good on them. And screw these companies for keeping free options away from the people.
Seriously. Especially by tricking people like that. That's the one thing about these tax software people, is that it isn't just Intuit that does this.
They all do it.
Yeah. And it's incredibly exploitive and unfair and, you know, basically theft. But yeah. And then we have this other just really sad story out of Ohio. A pastor has had to file a federal lawsuit against the city of Bryan because he was being charged for housing homeless people during their blizzard.
Yeah, he was charged with zoning violations for housing people experiencing homelessness Earlier this year, he, Pastor Chris Lavelle, decided to keep the doors of his church, called Dad's Place, open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to reach out to the city's most vulnerable.
Yep.
And this is a small city, about 8,600 people, not too far west of Toledo.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he was hit with 18 zoning violations in December, claimed he had violated a city ordinance that says residents can't stay on the first floor of that property. Further, the local fire chief found a slew of fire code violations at the church. Pleaded not guilty to the charges at his January 11th arraignment. Now he's suing the city, claiming discrimination on the basis of religion, and claiming city officials have launched a harassment campaign against the church. So, city argues that Avell had been given time to comply with the ordinance after receiving warnings, but apparently refused. So, yeah. He had 10 days to kick out locals staying at the church.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's just effing terrible.
Yeah.
Like, he's doing what the Bible actually asks you to do. And it's just, it's, yeah. I mean, what more can you add to it?
Yeah.
But anyway, all right, so that was the show proper. It's now time to move on to the proper show proper, where we get to the main stuff. And probably the big story this week was that, as we all know what happened, former President Trump won the GOP New Hampshire primary. And of course, the flip side of that is current President Joseph R. Biden won the Dem primary as a write-in candidate.
Yeah, yeah, that's basically it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they... Yeah, the way that the Dems are handling the primary stuff with New Hampshire, they meant that Biden was not a part on the ballot itself.
Mm-hmm.
But people wrote him in. He won handily, 64% of the vote. So
yeah,
didn't really stress too much on that.
Mm-mm. Yeah, it was. Yeah, and so I mean, we all kind of knew that, you know, him winning was going to happen. And because of that, Ron DeSantis dropped out of the presidential race just before the New Hampshire primary and, you know, endorsed Trump, of course. Again, we kind of all figured that was going to happen, too.
Yeah, but, you know, giving up after one week seemed pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
It basically kind of ruined his political reputation.
In the process, yeah. I mean, he already kind of had a cruddy reputation to begin with, but yeah, this one just kind of showed him as spineless. And so yeah, that happened. But however, Nikki Haley is still in it because she actually managed to get more of the percentage of the vote than people thought she was going to get. So she apparently still thinks she has a shot.
Yeah. She said she does not want to be the vice president for Trump. So
yeah,
that's a bold choice because she's not going to win anyway.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. And then there was this other story. New Hampshire's Attorney General's office is investigating a bunch of robocalls that went out to the public. It was an AI generated thing that used Biden's voice that told people not to vote.
Yeah. Yeah. To tell voters not to cast their ballot in the state's presidential primary on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although the voice in the robocall sounds like the voice of President Biden, the message appears to be artificially generated based on initial indications. Mm-hmm. It's basically saying your vote makes a difference in November, not this Tuesday.
Yeah.
Which is generally a pretty cut and dry sort of voter suppression tactic.
Mm-hmm.
By who? I don't know, but I'm sure
nobody knows yet.
Yeah, they're going to try and figure it out.
Yeah. And moving on from there, well, if you've been paying any attention to the news, you know that the tech industry is going through a sort of there's issues. See, the tech industry has making a ton of profit, some of the biggest profits they've ever had. Yet the flip side of it is that they're doing these massive layoffs in turn because of it. And so early 2024, this week, we got eBay, which laid off over 1,000 people.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
About 9% of its workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as they face a business slowdown.
Mm-hmm.
which I don't know what that means. Saying their company's staff and expenses have outpaced the growth of our business. We'll see what that really means here, but seems like maybe they hired too many people at a certain point.
Could be.
But yeah, that's a little weird, but...
Evidently.
Yeah, and this is after they previously cut about 500 workers last February.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like a yearly thing for them.
Yep.
Maybe it's less people using eBay.
It's possible.
But I guess we'll wait and see how their business goes.
Yeah. And on top of that, TikTok laid off about 60 people.
Yeah, it's not that much, mostly in the company's sales and advertising division, who attributed the shakeup to a routine reorganization. Affecting people in L.A., New York, Austin, and abroad. So it seems like they're going, they probably had a town hall to discuss that. But yeah, they have about 7,000 people, so this isn't a major shakeup, but still people getting laid off. For reasons that are probably internal. Like people not making good decisions with the way they're taking their company.
Yeah. Yeah. So moving on from there. That was more or less the more or less serious stuff we're having this week. We're now moving on to the non-serious stuff, more like the science and entertainment part of the show. First and foremost, Japan has announced that they are shutting down its moon lander, codenamed Slim, to save battery in the hopes it'll be able to restart later.
Yeah. Yeah, they've said that the... Let's see here. Yeah, the battery level of 12%, the battery was disconnected as planned.
Yeah.
Plan to hopefully leave enough juice for a potential restart. I'm not sure if this is one that, the solar cells, it has solar cells that are facing west. So if sunlight begins to shine on the lunar surface from the west, there's a possibility of generating power and they are preparing for recovery. So maybe kind of let it sit for a bit and maybe charge up a bit.
Yeah.
Before they continue working on stuff there, more stuff there. So, yeah, but they have not specified a time frame for when that may be more favorable for them. So we'll have to see how that goes. But yeah, they managed to land a lunar lander over there to explore the surface. Yeah, they're the fifth country to achieve a soft landing on the moon. So that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Slim for smart lander for investigating moon. So pretty good name there.
Yeah. Yeah. So now we're moving on to the entertainment portion. The first story of the entertainment portion, of course, is Oppenheimer, as you can probably much expect, leads all films and Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, let's be honest, we all saw that one coming.
Yeah, 13 nominations. Poor Things at 11, Killers of the Flower Moon at 10, Barbie at 8, and Maestro at 7 is sort of the top movies there.
Yeah.
And Barbie got snubbed for a few things. Best director, Greta Gerwig did not get for that, which is a shame for her.
Yeah.
And then what's her name for Barbie for lead actress? Would have been a great choice, but not that.
Oh, like, yeah.
The ones that did make it were not deserving of that.
Oh,
but
yes.
Margot Robbie definitely put in a hell of a performance as
mm-hmm.
for a character you would not expect to do that much.
Yeah.
But yeah, they got, I think in the music category, they got two songs in there. There's the I'm Just Ken and What Was I Made For? So that's like a category they're probably going to win at least. But they also got, you know, best adapted screenplay. They got supporting role with America Ferrera, who's the sort of human counterpart to Barbie. As the source of her experiencing these weird feelings you know, as she jokes about in there. So,
yeah.
But yeah, they got in for Best Picture along with American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, and The Zone of Interest. I believe in the week of this, Barbie's gone back into theaters.
Yep.
For a bit for people to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Animated film has a good list here. Yeah, Boy and the Heron, Elemental, Nimona, Robot Dreams, and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
Yep.
The international film's kind of disappointing. It's the thing about the category is that these countries can only put up one film. So Japan put up Perfect Days, which is a great film. But also Godzilla Minus One would have been easily worthy of being on there as well.
Oh, so very much, yes.
And it's like, yeah, that's disappointing there. Feels like they should open that up for more. Because, again, there's more than five foreign films worthy of nomination there. But the Oscars are kind of slow to change with the times.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, and now for probably the best news we got all week. Jon Stewart is returning to The Daily Show as a guest host on Mondays.
Yeah, at least through election season. As they continue to flop around and not know what they're going to do with that show. And have run off talented people in the wake of that. But yeah. He'll be fun. He'll be, I think, he's potentially going to also be an executive producer for the show as well for the foreseeable future, which makes sense since his Apple show got shut down. So he's got not much to do in this sort of topic here. Or, yeah, this part of the entertainment industry that he likes to be in. So maybe they'll end up in a weird part, you know, a spot where they're just having different people host different days, but they really need to just pick somebody and not screw around so much. Otherwise, nobody will want that job.
Yeah. Seriously. Remember, I'm not sure if it was last week, maybe a couple weeks ago, we talked about how there was a new George Carlin quote-unquote special that was made up, that was AI generated. His estate is filing a lawsuit against the group who are behind it. So,
yeah, Dudesy, the media company behind the AI generated hour long comedy special George Carlin, I'm Glad I'm Dead. Not surprising. His daughter very much put up a big statement saying that she disavowed this whole special going live and. They filed the suit in California federal court on Thursday. So, seeking court order for an immediate removal of the special plus an unspecified amount in damages. Alleging that the company infringed on copyright by using Carlin's materials to train the chatbot without seeking permission or licensing.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was just in general a really shitty thing that they did. But yeah, now we're moving on to, the Netflix related and the trailer stuff. First and foremost, some honestly rather unfortunate news. Netflix has scrapped the release of The Mothership after post-production delays. This was a sci-fi movie that Halle Berry was starring in. And apparently the movie was all done, but this is another one of those examples where they decided it was better to just shelve it and, you know, use it as a tax write-off. So.
Yeah,
I guess
it still needed some post-production work, and they had delays getting that done, so they just decided to stop trying to do that. Sad for that, but she's still working with Netflix. She has an action film coming out, I think, this year called The Union, about a construction worker, Mark Wahlberg, who was roped into the espionage world by his former high school girlfriend. She's also directing her directorial debut is with Netflix on a movie called Bruised, a sports drama about a disgraced MMA fighter who reconnects with her estranged son, reclaims her power. So still working with Netflix, but yeah, sad to see that go. But yeah, kind of a movie affected by the pandemic big time. they finished that in 2021, and yeah, still almost 3 years later, they're still having trouble getting it done, so not too surprising.
Hmm. Yeah. And, yeah, Netflix also signed a huge deal with the WWE to get live episodes of Monday Night Raw.
Yeah. And this is a bigger deal than you might think. So they, see, starts in January 2025, 10 years for $500 million per year.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is in the U.S., what regions is this? I think it's U.S., U.K., mm-hmm. Canada, Latin America, and other territories. Once the deal begins, with more countries and regions to be added over time, Netflix will also become a television home for all WWE shows outside the U.S. That includes the other weekly shows, SmackDown and NXT, mm-hmm. as well as the annual live events like WrestleMania, SummerSlam, and Royal Rumble, like the pay-per-views, as well as documentaries, original series, and additional projects. So they're getting a whole host of stuff for people outside the U.S., which seems like a hell of a deal and a reason to get the VPN there, to go outside the U.S. to watch pay-per-views for that. Currently, you can watch that stuff on Peacock, as well as their like archival stuff with all the old like WCW and WWE shows and all that, and pay-per-views and all that stuff. So it's definitely a big deal for Netflix to kind of jump into the live sports arena, as they really haven't had much of anything that's been live. And they've got a year to get ready for this. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and moving on from there, we now have some trailers. The first trailer we got is the official trailer for Netflix's live-action adaptation of Avatar: The Last Airbender, and already this looks so much better than the M. Night Shyamalan version. I mean, granted, that's a very low bar to go over, but, you know.
Yeah. Let's see. Starts February 22nd. As somebody that has not seen any of the show, this looks pretty solid. Does look a bit silly in some bits. That's just what you're going to get with the adaptation from, you know, animation to live action. But most of it looks really good. So yeah, that'll be out in about a month. Like the weird thing is when like the Aang's arrow thing just starts lighting up. It looks very video gamey in the way that it looks in the show. So. Well, yeah, that looks neat.
Yeah. And we also got the official trailer for Prime Video's at version of Roadhouse. I'm guessing this is a remake of the cult Patrick Swayze movie.
Yep. Yeah, it features Jake Gyllenhaal, who is an ex-UFC fighter, who takes a job as a bouncer at a Florida Keys Roadhouse. Only discover that this is a weirdly aggressive business for fights. So, yeah. Looks pretty decent. Though this is a movie I've never seen the original. I probably should at some point, but...
Yeah.
This is out March 21st on Prime, so...
Yeah.
I will not be seeing it.
So, yeah.
There you go.
And last but not least, we got an official trailer for Monkey Man.
Yeah, this looks pretty interesting. So this is a Dev Patel vehicle, I guess. He's directing it as well as producing it, and he's starring in it. Jordan Peele is executive producing this. And yeah, it's basically what if you did Indian John Wick?
Yep.
Where... it's sort of based around the myth of the Monkey Man, essentially. Yeah, the legend of Hanuman, an icon embodying strength and courage, is like a monkey figure, almost maybe like the Son Goku.
Yeah,
in the legend of the West, Journey of the West kind of thing. But yeah, features Dev Patel as this kid who survived his village's burning down and sort of somebody who's doing all sorts of odd jobs to survive and decides to try to take down the sinister, you know, underground of the city that he's in, and involves him, you know, beating up people, shooting people. Also, he's having some silly moments because there's a bit where he tries to jump out a window and just bounces off of it.
Yep.
As he realizes he's not that good, but
yeah,
he's still fucking up people a lot throughout this. So,
oh yeah,
it looks like it's going to be pretty good.
Yeah,
it'll be out April 5th.
Yeah. That I believe is our show, folks. Yeah, that is our show for this week. So, I would like to remind all of our listeners, you got a question, comment, something you want us to read on the air, you can get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for it in the show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at Google Play, RSS, archive.org, or any kind of podcast aggregator that you can think of. So, we're going to go ahead and wind it all down here. If you enjoyed what you heard, please do not hesitate to share us with your friends, your family, your coworkers, your casual acquaintances, your mortal enemies, or everywhere in between. Because they may hate you, but they may love us. And that's a beat we can all dance to. Except for you, because they hate you. But, yeah. So, once again, thank you, Chris, for joining me tonight. We're going to go ahead and end it here. And we will be seeing you all next week in February. So, hope that your last week of January goes well, and we will see you guys next week. Good night, everybody.